This morning, we want to welcome you all to the Supreme Court hearing room and have a special welcome for students who are with us. We have students from Oconomowoc High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. Thank you for coming. And we have students from Banner Preparatory School. Would they please stand? We want to thank you all for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the Supreme Court and the State Bar of Wisconsin. We invite students across the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is picked up, we send the students material about the case that they will be present for, and these students are sent not only materials, but may engage in activities relating to the case at school. They come, and after this second case, the students will hear a justice was assigned for that day, and the discussion will be about the procedures, how the court takes cases and decides them. The discussion is not on the substantive issues of the case. Everyone's invited to join the students for this discussion. With those, let me just ask, would anyone like a summary of the case we're about to hear? If you raise your hands, the marshal will distribute the summary. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Michael Gableman. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack, with whom you're going to meet after this hearing. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Justice Annette Ziegler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case for today, 08AP2045, Evelyn Werner versus Kenneth Henry. Arguing on behalf of Evelyn Werner is Attorney Joseph F. Owens. Mr. Owens.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors, guests, opposing counsel.
Good morning.
That's so far. May it please the court, I'm here as counsel for the appellant, Evelyn Werner, who has since deceased this summer on June 30th. I'm representing her special administrator at this point in time, her surviving brother. He's also the named trustee in her trust. As the court knows, this case really involves two separate cases within one. There's a case against a gentleman who was an employee of the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. And that man used his access to her, a wheelchair-bound woman. He made house calls when there are complaints to the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance about, in her case, some annuities she felt were not properly being administered by insurance companies. And he was investigating that for the state. And in the course of his investigation, he made many visits to her house in rural and isolated Sussex, Wisconsin, in Waukesha County. When he made those visits, he found out a lot about her. He found out that she had a number of investments. She had a safe in her house. He found out the location of the safe, and he knew the contents of the safe. He went many times to her house over a year and a half period of time, from September of one year till approximately October of another. All during this time, he was an employee and an investigator for the Commissioner of Insurance. His name was Kenneth Henry. At the same time this was going on, Mr. Henry was a charged felon in Dane County Circuit Court. And, in fact, right around the time of the last visit with her in October of 08, a bench warrant had issued for his arrest, and he was to be held without bail on bail-jumping charges. Now, this period of time is relevant to us because he was casing her. He was finding out when her providers of service would be there. What he came at odd hours, days, nights, weekends. So he would find out what times of the schedule were her providers. And he was then, we don't know why, but on November 1 of that year, he terminated his relationship with the Office of the Commissioner of Insurance. 6 weeks later, he led a home invasion, pistol whipped her, stole her safe, and in a trial that was held in his absence, a default hearing, which included a doctor testifying, she testified, the woman who interrupted the robbery testified, who happened to be an off-duty alcohol, firearm, tobacco investigator, thank God, was armed, and she broke up the robbery. Evelyn talked about the fact that a sheet was laying next to her in a wheelchair, and they were going to shoot her and carry her out in the sheet. She was bound and gagged, and she was masked with a pillow. She recognized Mr. Hendry by his voice. That's where we get into the issue of, certainly, was he or was he not acting within the scope of his duties as an agent of the state of Wisconsin? And the answer is clearly not in the home invasion. But all of the information that he gleaned that set it up was gleaned while and during his conduct as an insurance commissioner investigator from the office.
Counsel, in the trial to the court on his liability to your client, did the court make a finding that, in fact, he was one of the robbers? In other words, he's not been adjudicated guilty by a criminal court, is my understanding.
That's correct.
Did the circuit court make a determination that, in fact, he robbed her?
I would say it was a default hearing. He didn't show. The complaint alleged it, so the answer would be by default they made that finding.
All right, so the finding was by default, and then she had to prove up her damages? Is that what happened?
Well, she had to prove up the liability, the identification, the voice identification, at least give a prima facie case, which she did, and then that supported the finding of the default in that no defense was presented.
Okay, so, but the damages, I assume, She got $175,420.77, so
That's correct.
Must have been some proof of damages.
Oh, absolutely. The doctor testified, and the medical bills were put in, and the court made its own findings. Judge Foster, Catherine Foster, made those findings.
Okay, all right. That's all I need to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So what's your theory of how you get the state of Wisconsin?
The theory on the state of Wisconsin for Mr. Hendry, the invader. Your Honor, as opposed to Mr. Honig.
Well, what you really want is a judgment. You want money from the state,
correct.
Right? Okay,
correct.
So how do you get there?
Well, 895.46 is the statute. It says, state to pay judgments taken against officers. That's its title. And it has three sections.
But do they have to be within the scope of their employment?
They have to be carrying out, because of acts, if we look at the language of the statute is a very interesting statute. It says, the state, if a person is proceeded against because of acts committed while carrying out duties, that's the first step. Then it says, and the court finds that the defendant was acting within the scope of employment, judgment shall be paid by the state. That's first part of paragraph one of that statute. Now, there was an express finding by the court that he was acting within the scope of his duties when he was casing her joint. That's cited in the brief. She made that finding. All this was done on motions to dismiss initially when the orders that are appealed from granted. So that statute is the statute upon which we rely, and she made a finding that he was acting within the scope when he visited her home, found out of her schedule, found out of her holdings, found out about the safe, and he successfully actually removed the safe. He stole the safe. All those things occurred because of what he learned, because of acts committed while carrying out his duties, which was investigating this insurance complaint she had started the whole thing with about annuities. That's the first phase. Now, the Attorney General, in the second part of this statute, is authorized to appear on behalf of the state because it may have to pay this judgment vicariously, and then They may contest whether the acts grew out of or were committed in. And that's the language. Grew out of or committed. And if we go back to the notice of claim statute, Justice Ziegler, which is the first threshold which one must go through, there's a very lengthy process of giving notice, as we all know, to the Attorney General within 120 days of the events, et cetera, et cetera. And all those were done. There is a complaint by the Attorney General that that was not sufficient with regard to Mr. Hendry also. But that was complied with. It was a 7-page notice of claim. It's in our appendix. And it met all the statutory minimums of the names, place, times, and I believe that's what it is, the natures of the claim, the circumstances of the word in the statute. The Attorney General did not appear in this case and contest that issue. They did not appear on that basis. They had filed no motion to dismiss. They did not appear on behalf. They did not assert discretionary immunity, judicial immunity, governmental immunity, any kind of immunity. And we all know immunity is an affirmative defense under 80206, must be pled or waived, cited in my brief. And there was no argument that he acted outside the scope or inside the scope of his duties. It never came up. The Attorney General's position is that the last sentence of this statute should govern the entire statute, which governs the reimbursement or the indemnification for attorney's fees and costs of defense. The Attorney General has a different view of the statute than the language of the first paragraph and says, even if the person is acting within the scope and even if the court finds that he's acting within the scope, he's immune if he doesn't cooperate in his defense. And that language is at the very end of sub 1 of 895.46. And it's all about attorney's fees and expenses. It says if the officer, employee, or agent of the state refuses to cooperate in the defense of the litigation, the officer, employee, or agent is not eligible for any indemnification or for the provision of legal counsel by the governmental unit under this section. The Attorney General argued and got an order, and that's all they got, because they never contested scope of authority or scope of duties, was that he did not cooperate in the defense of his litigation, and they read that phrase, any indemnification, as all of the obligation of the state to pay for, which up above is not identified as indemnification, says state shall pay to the third party, the injured party. Down here, at the end of the statute, it's talking about indemnifying the agent or the employee for his costs and attorney's fees, or hers. And you don't get that if you don't cooperate in your defense.
Well, am I reading you or hearing you correctly that the rule between the state and the injured party is the state pays?
Yes.
If you fall, if you prove within sub 1A, right?
The first paragraph.
Official capacity, acts committed while carrying out duties within the scope of employment shall be paid.
Yes.
But you could name in a lawsuit both you could name the individual defendant, and he's liable, too.
Oh, yes.
So you have two people on the hook. One, the state shall pay. And two, that the defendant can also pay. You can only collect once.
Correct.
But the last sentence, I understand you, is a protection for the defendant, for the state, against the particular officer, against the particular state employee, that if the state employee just throws in the hat and really cooperates with the plaintiff, the state's not going to pay him back.
Pay his attorney's fees or his expenses.
For indemnification, right.
Right. Well, indemnification for his attorney's fees and costs.
Right. Then it comes under the last sentence.
Yes, Your Honor. Now,
has nothing to do with the plaintiff and the state. That's your position.
That is my position, Your Honor. And I believe that the Attorney General is seeking to use this case to expand the historic definition and application of this statute. The opinion of the Attorney General cited in their brief from 1986 attempts to do this, and they're trying to bootstrap that argument. And you'll see it's quoted in their brief. I believe it's on page 10 of their brief. And it's quoting 75, opinion of the Attorney General, 182. And this was an opinion requested about whether or not the Historic Society, actually the Sites Foundation, by adding to the group of entities that would be granted this coverage, would or would not violate the constitutional prohibition on lending the state's credit to someone, an individual. And in that context, the Attorney General says, well, this is an indemnification statute, and this language that we now see quoted, and now for the first time being presented to this court, and you're being asked to adopt, and the trial court did adopt, the argument that if they refuse to cooperate, the state doesn't pay. And they've taken the last sentence and moved it up to the front of the statute. Now there are two ways that the state doesn't pay. Not within the scope or failure to cooperate. Now, any time a state officer is engaged in something that might be criminal, I'm sure his or her attorney in the criminal prosecution is going to say, don't talk to the Attorney General. I think the Attorney General's office would have a conflict of interest, as probably in Mr. Hendry's case, when Hendry's defense counsel undoubtedly said, do not talk to the Attorney General.
Counselor, would you agree that your argument applies only to the compensatory damages and
yes.
that the state is not on the hook for the punitive damages?
Absolutely. Okay. And I also agree that the limitation, although not pled by the Attorney General, as well as the immunity not pled, we have a case that this court ruled on, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago. I think Justice Kirks wrote the opinion that said you can't waive the cap, the $250,000 cap, in 895-46.
Mr. Owens, let me take you back a little bit, because I see the way at least I approach this case as you're a little ahead of where I am. My understanding is that the trial court and the Court of Appeals in affirming the trial court looked at timeliness of an appeal. And so it seems to me that that's your threshold question. You've got to get us convinced, if you're going to be successful here, that indeed what occurred here was timely. How do you get there?
Well, you're, as we pointed out in the brief, we know the facts are that the trial judge did not intend and agreed with Mr. Glinsky and Mr. Shaw on a stipulated basis that these preliminary orders on the motion to dismiss were going to be withheld against Hendry and Honeck until the conclusion of the liability phase against Hendry. And we know that the judge, Judge Foster, said that. We know we have a handwritten notation on a letter from Mr. Shaw to the court confirming that agreement. And she writes, this is true, arrow, in her initials, to the clerk. The clerk apparently didn't see that. Some of you have been circuit court judges, I know. And it's a busy place, and things happen that are by mistake. And the clerk, probably trying to be efficient, went ahead and got a signature on. But Judge Foster herself stated that she would hold the order. And she says, and it's quoted on page 6 of my brief. Shaw says, Your Honor, with respect to the order, can we wait on this until the thing has all come to cover and incorporated an appeal? The court says, I can do that. So if you submit an order in effect at your leisure, Mr. Glinsky, I will hold it beyond 5 days, then, pending resolution of the order for judgment on liability. And it cites us, and the appendix is in there. There's a longer discussion, but it's very clear that the court is agreeing to the stipulation of counsel that she says hold the order. Now, does she mean hold entry or hold rendition? There's been an argument made by the Attorney General in its brief that even if it's a mistake by the clerk, too bad, so sad.
Well, let me ask you this. In regard to Mr. Hendry, is it your claim that the orders that were filed, let's see, she apparently signed them in December, they got filed, and then they got filed again in April, but she didn't hold a trial on liability and damages specifically till June, The judgment itself is entered in July. The appeal is in August. Is it your claim that what she had done in regard to Mr. Hendry was not a final order that could be appealed except by leave of the Court of Appeals?
Yes, Your Honor. With regard to Hendry, absolutely.
What about in regard to Mr. Honick?
I think the argument I just made about mistake, clerical error, and interests of justice applies to Mr. Honick. The clerical error issue was raised in the Edlund case, and we believe that the Court of Appeals sidestepped the Edlund obligation to do justice and correct an error when it would have destroyed the appellate jurisdiction, when everyone had agreed, including the Court, that this was going to be held open on both cases. But that relates to Honick particularly. To Hendry, his litigation was not concluded. And then the Court of Appeals, as we know, engaged in this supercilious argument that says, well, the state could have been a party, therefore it was a final order as to them, even though they weren't a party. And actually, we know Mr. Glinsky and his attorney general says, no, the state could never have been a party. And they couldn't. Even with Stat 895-46, as Justice Ziegler points out, does not allow states to be sued directly. It's a vicarious liability statute. We'll pay the judgment if, but it's not a direct action statute.
Am I correct that when the counsel, who was the counsel at trial, brought this matter before Judge Foster, that he argued in regard to basically setting aside or vacating these earlier orders, that she should consider equitable matters, equitable considerations, such as the kinds of things you've been outlining?
Oh, yes, Judge. And then there was an appeal that is still held in abeyance in the Court of Appeals of her denial of that. It's not part of our case here, but that's being held pending the outcome of this Court's decision.
But he was making, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, he was making equitable arguments somewhat similar to the Edlund case?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And you're writing that same case at this point?
I am. In both instances. I think it applies in both instances. The 806-07 request for relief, as well as this. And by the way, Your Honor, I wanted to point out something that I just missed when I was talking about this entry issue. If we're going to be hyper-technical, let's notice that the statute actually that we're talking about here, 806-06, rendition, perfection, and entry, only applies to judgments, not orders. This was an order, not a judgment. And if we're going to be hyper-technical, I don't think that 806-06 applies to orders. It applies to just judgments. And there is a distinction because the very next statute is 806-07, relief from judgments or orders. And this was an order.
Should we give any significance to what was written on these orders, that these orders were final for purposes of appeal? How does that enter into this?
I think that language is requested by this Court in its order of maybe a year and a half ago or 2 years ago for all orders which are intended upon their appropriate entry to give notice to everyone it's time for an appeal on this point. And so, yes, but it's the timing that we're back to. Can a clerical error by a clerk destroy the appellate rights of someone, which first emerges on appeal, in violation of the stipulation and the judge's own statements of record? I think in this day and age of when the public has its own questions about the way and the integrity, shall we say, of the judicial system, to be fair, I think we need to be aware of the fact that this hyper-technical would be highly suspected, probably criticized by many of the non-lawyers, shall we say, in the world, and many lawyers as well.
Counsel, I think that's what we call the rule of law.
That's
sometimes
correct. The rule of law.
You know, there's the argument, there's always the tension between equity and doing what you think is justice, and then the rules. You know, what do the rules say, and the timeliness, and I want to take you back to Edlund, because you say your argument is based on Edlund. Edlund, in the very last paragraph, says this is a very narrow holding. And it says, we conclude that under, in the penultimate paragraph, We conclude that under the circumstances of this case, the circuit court's mistake constitutes a compelling, equitable consideration. So equity is involved under the circumstances of this case. And so we set out what the circumstances of the case were. In that case, it was Judge Perlich, who was a trial judge in La Crosse, and he alone made the mistake. That was one circumstance. The court alone, the mistake was one committed by the circuit court alone. The second one was, and under the facts of Edlin, he intended to send out the memorandum decision and just didn't. And when it was way beyond the deadline, some attorneys noticed it came to their attention, so it was beyond the deadline. So we had here, number one, the mistake was one committed by the circuit court alone. This is the last paragraph. The court acknowledged committing the mistake, and the circuit court's mistake is had evidence by more than after-the-fact acknowledgement by the court. So those were the three considerations. In this case, now we've got Hendry, Honig, immunity, and indemnification. So this is, I always had to make notes, which is Hendry or Honig, immunity, indemnification. On the Honig, it's my understanding, and the Honig is the immunity. It's my understanding from the record that, unlike in Edlin, that Werner's attorney had actual notice of the error in time to ask the circuit court to vacate it. Am I right or wrong with that understanding of the facts of this case?
I think that's wrong, Your Honor.
And tell me why you think it's wrong.
The argument that he had actual notice is an implied notice, that when the docket entry was created, that the docket, when it was sent out from the clerk's office after the notice of appeal had been sent, was supposed to give him notice of the entry of these orders, and he should have noticed it. He should have noticed it. Not that he did notice it, not that he had actual notice, and that was many days after, I mean months after the entry. The docket thing went out in, I think, July, and the entry of the order had happened in, April and December. So which one do you want to pick? And this was an error by the court, if I may jump back.
Well, is there a difference between the court and the clerk?
Well, it certainly was the trial judge who says, on the record, I will hold the order. That means I'm going to hold the order. And she didn't. She didn't do that. She apparently signed it. What she meant by hold, and what we all mean the hold, she meant clearly in the context, so that your appeal time, he said, I don't have a problem with my appeal. Let's wait till it's all done. She says, right, we'll do that. I'll hold the order. Now, that was a mistake by the court, by the judge. And she has her own handwritten notation.
So
this
correct. Was a mistake alone? Here the mistake was one committed by the circuit court alone. You're saying
I think, well, the circuit court judge, certainly. And now the clerk compounded it, I suppose. But the clerk seemed to follow what the statute says. Once it's signed, do it. Once it's rendered, enter it. The judge said she was going to withhold. She was going to hold. I think that was an error by the judge. We have these two cases going almost at the same time.
Mr. Owen.
I have a red light. That means I got to stop talking.
Yes. That's the point of my interruption.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
John J. Glinsky, Assistant Attorney General, representing Mr. Honig.
May it please the Court, my name is John Glinsky. I'm Assistant Attorney General, and I represent Respondent Honig and the State of Wisconsin to the extent that it's involved in this appeal. With respect to the orders themselves, that's certainly an unfortunate situation that occurred. However, equity does come into play here, and I don't think Werner has clean hands, as they say, in this situation, because not only was she informed when the court in October sent out the appeal index that these orders had been filed at least no later than April 2nd, but in my brief in the Court of Appeals, I specifically raised the issue because I thought I had an obligation to inform the court that it might not have jurisdiction. I also realized at the time that the year in which Werner could ask the court, circuit court, to vacate and re-enter the orders would not have passed by the time she got my brief. So I thought a reasonable compromise was to do what I thought I had to do and raise it briefly in my responsive brief, which would then give Werner a month in which to move the circuit court to vacate and re-enter the orders. However, there was no...
Did the circuit court lose jurisdiction to do anything once it comes up to the court?
No, not in that instance, Your Honor. There's a statute that specifically provides for that, and that's mentioned in my brief.
Okay.
So the two opportunities that Werner had to get this corrected were not taken advantage of, which is at least a big part of the reason why we end up here, I guess, on that issue. In terms of whether it was
fine. Mr. Glinski, let me interrupt you, if I might, at this point, because I want to clarify just what you were talking about. My understanding is that when these motions were brought in July, I believe, by the trial counsel, that Judge Foster ruled under 806.07.1a that the year was gone. Is that correct?
Well, that was after all of this occurred.
I know. This was later when there was a motion to vacate the orders.
Right.
She held a hearing on that.
And that's the appeal that's pending and been stayed.
Right. And my understanding is that she said, too bad, so sad, not in those words, but that under 806.07.1a, it's beyond 1 year, so I can't do anything. My question to you is, since there were arguments, and we've gone back and looked at the transcript, since there were arguments about equitable considerations, could she not have looked at 806.07.1h and utilized that? That doesn't, as I remember it, require a year limitation.
Well, Your Honor, my recollection is that the trial court did point out that the facts in this case were not similar to those in Edlund, the reason being that Werner was given notification twice within the year and could have moved and failed to do so, so that the equitable considerations that normally would overrule the public policy and the final disposition of matters simply didn't come into play. The orders themselves, if you look at the order, I guess there's no question regarding the order regarding Defendant Honig, but regarding the one regarding Mr. Hendry, that was brought by the Attorney General on behalf of the state, which is authorized by 895.46(1A). And if you look at the order itself, which can be found at the appendix in Werner's brief, page 111, it says, a hearing having been held on November 28, 2007, on the state of Wisconsin's motion for a ruling that Defendant Hendry is not eligible for indemnification under 895.46, plaintiff having appeared by Attorney Shaw, state of Wisconsin having appeared by John Glinski, Defendant Hendry not having appeared, the court having read the briefs and considered the oral arguments of the parties, and having reviewed the record, the court having decided for the reasons stated on the record that the motion should be granted, it is ordered that the motion of the state of Wisconsin is granted and Defendant Hendry is not eligible for indemnification under 895.46. Well, if you look at the reasons stated in the record, not only is it he's not entitled to indemnification because he didn't cooperate in the defense, but if you look at the same appendix, page 154, I had asked the court, quote, is the court also making a finding then that Mr. Hendry, that nothing has been alleged that would have been within the scope of employment, unquote. Court, correct. Me, prior to Mr. Henry, prior to his leaving the employment of his insurance commissioner. Trial court, correct. So the court made two findings. One, that Mr. Henry had not cooperated in the defense, which is why we did not represent him, and also that he was not within the scope of his employment, not only when the break-in occurred, because he had resigned 6 weeks prior to that, but also prior to that resignation in terms of the actions that by him that had been alleged. And that's what this was based on. It was based on the pleadings and the allegations in those pleadings. So we really don't have any vicarious liability on behalf of the state to begin with, because Mr. Henry had been found not to have been acting within the scope of his employment.
Counselor, if the trial court really meant to do that, it goes back to my first question to opposing counsel. What kind of findings was she making and in the default judgment hearing? If she was really making that determination and it was alleged in the complaint and there was no denial, there was no answer filed on his behalf, how is it that you can controvert something that's been pled and not answered? You got me on that. I don't see where the trial court can do what you said she did and then continue on and have a hearing based on a default of the complaint, which included the same allegation that you're telling me the trial court said she set aside. They seem inconsistent to me.
This motion wasn't brought, obviously, on behalf of Mr. Henry. It was brought on behalf of the state to establish that the state would not be responsible to indemnify Mr. Henry for any judgment.
I understand that you were representing the state. I'm a little unclear why the state didn't implead itself, but that, I guess, is a matter of your choice. What I don't understand is how you can't have two different facts. Either he was or he wasn't acting within the scope of his employment. And if the trial court made the finding during the course of your hearing before her, then how could she also grant a default judgment on the pleadings? I mean, I understand the latter part. There was no answer filed. You chose not to represent him. And so there was no answer filed to the allegation that what he did was during the scope of his employment.
Well, the liability at the hearing you're talking about was way afterwards. That was involved the trial for damages. And there, the liability was for the break-in. What the court decided here, what we're talking about here, is based on the allegations in the complaint. The court found that nothing had been alleged in the complaint that would have put Henry within the scope of his employment. They're completely two different issues.
Even
and the state wasn't involved in the trial itself.
It may have been two different issues. But it isn't two different issues when you've got a trial court that's essentially ruling on a default judgment motion. In other words, in the complaint, it was alleged that he acted within the scope of his employment. Right?
Well, what the court found, though, that
I understand your position. My problem is trying to square a motion on a default judgment, okay, which assumes everything not denied is admitted, right? And you're telling me that the court found that there was nothing alleged in the complaint that showed he was acting within the scope of his employment. I mean, you can't have it both ways.
The default judgment wasn't based on his
based
being
on
within
the
scope of employment. It was based on the break-in, that he was the one that committed the break-in, and that was after he resigned his employment. So the issue of whether he was employed at that point was irrelevant. He had resigned 6 weeks before that.
I don't think the issue is ever irrelevant if you're going to try to get the state to pay the judgment that comes out of it.
Well, there's no finding at the trial on damages that he was within the scope of employment or that Honick even had notice of this.
Counsel, whatever happened to the sixth cause of action against Honick for negligent supervision of an employee?
That was dismissed in the other order that we're talking about, that the court also signed on December 3rd, but apparently was not entered until, well, either that date or April 2nd. But Honick was dismissed based on his motion to dismiss for failure to comply with the notice of claim statute and based on discretionary immunity. As far as the point about
I have to pester you once more. I'm looking at the amended complaint that I have in my book. And if you look at paragraph 3, it is alleged that Hendry was employed by the Office of Commissioner of Insurance. Defendant Hendry, in his individual capacity, acted within the scope of his employment. Okay? Following his resignation of employment, Hendry acted individually. Now, I assume there's a breakup there because the burglary occurred when he was no longer an employee. But unless I misunderstand opposing counsel's position, it's his position that all the information he gathered during these long inappropriate visits were taken during the course of his employment. And I thought that's what part of what was admitted by not answering. So maybe you can help me out with that. I'm still having some trouble.
Well, my understanding of it is that in terms of what it is alleged that Hendry had done, in other words, essentially acting after hours, was not within the scope of his employment. There's nothing alleged that he had done that would have been within the scope of his employment. He was not authorized to visit her after hours. None of this was done during normal hours.
Okay, so you're saying the whole of paragraph 3 in the amended complaint was really taken care of in the hearing that you had in regard to the scope of Hendry's employment?
Correct.
Okay, all right. Thank you. I understand your position better now. Thanks.
As far as the indemnification issue goes, the indemnity statute is designed to help public employees, in this case state employees, to indemnify them for judgments against them for actions committed during the course of their employment, provided they cooperate in the defense of the action. Hendry did neither. The indemnification that's referred to in the statute does not, in the last sentence of 895.46.1a, does not apply only to attorney's fees and costs of the action. It says, if the officer, employee, or agent of the state refuses to cooperate in the defense of the litigation, the officer, employee, or agent is not eligible for any indemnification or for the provision of legal counsel by the government unit under this section. That's why Hendry was not provided with counsel by our office. It's also why he was not entitled to indemnification, in addition to the fact that he wasn't acting within the scope of his employment. Either one would have been sufficient. The circuit court found both to be the case.
Indemnification relates to the relationship between you and the state employee, right?
The state and the state employee, yes.
Right. Doesn't affect whether the state pays the victim.
No, there's no obligation to pay the victim. It's an indemnity statute for the benefit of the state employee.
All right. If there's a state employee and he acts within the scope of his employment and causes damage, injury, and he refuses to cooperate in the litigation, does the state have to pay the victim?
No.
Why not?
Because the indemnification statute applies only to state employees acting within the scope of employment.
Indemnification is a relationship between the state and the state employee.
Right. That's the one to be indemnified.
That's right. That's an agreement between us, or a statutory term.
Right.
But if the victim is Justice Bradley, and you have a defendant who injures her in the scope of employment, but then refuses to cooperate, I don't see why the state isn't liable. I want to make the state liable under every provision of the first sentence, except cooperation. And if I can do that in my example, why isn't the state liable to Justice Bradley as the victim, even if the state doesn't have to pay me?
Well,
or the state, I happen to be independently wealthy, the state can come out after me.
Well, that is not the purpose of the statute, for one thing. The other thing is
the
victim.
Well, what's the purpose of the statute?
The victim
it
wouldn't
protect
be able to
Bradley?
The victim wouldn't be able to sue the state anyway because of sovereign immunity.
I know. That's why you didn't implead the state, right?
Well, no, because the statute provides that you can do what we did without waiving sovereign immunity. So it's taken care of by statute.
That's
right. So it wouldn't matter.
You're in there even if you're not a named party.
Right.
Okay. So you're in there. So why isn't the statute there to protect Justice Bradley damages she received if the employee is in the scope of employment?
Well, the history of the statute shows that it was for the benefit of the employees. If the employee doesn't want to take advantage of it, that's his or her call. There's nothing in the statute that creates an obligation in any way towards the tort victim. That would make the state liable even if a state employee didn't cooperate, in which case the state wouldn't even have been involved in the action. So why should the state pay a judgment taken against someone who won't cooperate and wasn't within the scope of employment?
Mr. Glinsky, let me follow up, if I might, with the Chief's question, because I've been troubled by somewhat the same thing. There's language in 895461A that states as follows. The judgment as to damages and costs entered against the officer or employee, except as provided in 146894, in excess of any insurance applicable to the officer or employee, shall be paid by the state or political subdivision of which the defendant is an officer or employee. Now, that doesn't sound like just indemnification language. It sounds like the state could be on the hook to pay the judgment. Why am I wrong in reading
it?
It's
never been interpreted that way, Your Honor. It's always been interpreted for the benefit of the state employee. One of the advantages of being a state employee, I suppose, is that if something like this happens, you are entitled to be indemnified by the state, to have the state pay the judgment. But there's nothing here that says that the victim is able to sue the state. Plus, because of sovereign immunity, how would they be able to do that anyway?
Well, what's the notice of claim statute all about? That talks about suing the state and subsection.
No, state employees. There's
state
no way.
Employee. Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right.
There's no waiver of sovereign immunity here, and there's no waiver of sovereign immunity in 895.46 because the statute explicitly says there's no waiver.
So you think that language that I was just reading would have to be read in light of the state's sovereign immunity?
Correct, Your Honor, because the statute specifically says it's not waived.
Does this apply to local units of government as well?
Yes, it does, except that they don't enjoy sovereign immunity.
Counselor, if you hook together the notice of claim statute, which talks about suing a state employee, and you do so, and you show the state employee acted within the scope of his employment, and he caused injury, and you look at the statute 895.46.1A that Justice Crooks just read, that said the state shall pay a judgment against an employee, you're telling us that doesn't mean what it says. It requires yet another step that the employee cooperate.
Well, that's what the statute says.
Well, tell me what you're reading. I've got the statute here in front of me, and tell me what. I'm right at the very top. If the defendant in any action or special proceeding is a public officer or employee, okay, was acting in the scope of his employment, the judgment and damages against the employee, except as provided in 146.89.4, which doesn't apply here, in excess of insurance, shall be paid by the state or political. It doesn't say that the employee has to cooperate in that first sentence. That's where I'm having some trouble.
No, but the last sentence talks about any indemnification.
But we're not talking about indemnification. Payment to a third party.
No, the history of the statute, though, clearly indicates it's an indemnification statute. It's always been referred to as an indemnification statute. You will not find a single reported case that supports the proposition you're making.
Do you have any case that supports your reading?
Yes, and they're cited in the brief.
Which one is the strongest case that supports your reading?
Well, Okay. Fiala versus Voight, the legislature.
Which one?
Fiala versus Voight, 93 West 2nd, 337. It's on page 10. That's one.
All right.
Stands for the proposition.
Give us the facts of that case.
Pardon?
I want the facts of the case.
I don't remember the facts right offhand, but I know it stands for the proposition that, as I stated, the legislature has not enacted any procedure whereby a judgment creditor may bring a direct action against a state founded upon the statutory obligation to indemnify a state employee tortfeasor.
You don't think the statute is self-executing then? What you say is that they would have had to sue the state, but that isn't the posture that we're in here. I think what we're talking past each other just a little bit. You said that there is no provision for someone in the circumstances of the plaintiff here to sue the state. I don't have a problem with that, but I don't know why the state is still relieved of the legislative directive to pay a judgment against a state employee. And you're telling me that 895.46 just can't be employed as an argument because you couldn't sue the state anyway, so therefore you can't use 895.46 to collect on the judgment. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I'm saying both. You can't sue the state, but also the cases cited on pages 10 and 11 of our brief indicate that the purpose of the statute is to indemnify a state employee. Creates no right to recover any judgment on behalf of the tortfeasor, not only because of sovereign immunity, but they simply doesn't create a right to do that, even if there wasn't any sovereign immunity.
Okay. Thank you very much. So then it works in the state's favor if the employees don't cooperate.
That's right. Sure does.
Well, it works to the disadvantage of the state employee foolish enough not to cooperate because then he or she would be solely liable for the judgment.
But if they're judgment-proof, might as well not cooperate because nobody
will
pay.
Well, someone's judgment-proof, they probably don't much care anyway, I suppose.
The last sentence of 895.46.1, if the officer, employee, et cetera, does that apply only to the state or does that apply to local governments as well?
It refers to officer, employer, agent of the state.
So that helps your argument, does it?
Well, if you're not talking about the state, then you've got respondeat superior applicable, so you've got vicarious liability, and the municipalities, counties, and cities, and so forth can be sued directly, which the state can't be. I mean, there's fairly significant distinction between the state and other public entities, governmental entities. This obviously refers to agents of the state. Whether there's something comparable in another statute that would give equal protection to municipalities, I don't know.
The argument has been made that if you prevail on the interpretation of the statute, there really is a strong incentive for certain employees not to cooperate with the state, because then the state gets off the hook. And if they don't have any money anyway, it's no skin off their nose. I mean, how do we deal with that? I mean, we just say that, well, that's the way it is.
Well, I don't know how you deal with it either, except that the solution doesn't lie in 895.46, because that's for the benefit of state employees. If they don't want to take advantage of it, that's up to them. And if they are judgment-proof and don't care if they get a judgment against them because they have no intention of ever paying it anyway, then I suppose they don't care. But that's for them to decide. It works to the disadvantage of the victim, of course, but that's not the state's fault. It's the fault of the state employee who doesn't care what happens for whatever reason, and fails to take advantage of the opportunities given in 895-46.
Counsel, I see this as akin to a policy of indemnification, insurance policy, which says we will pay all sums for which we are legally responsible to pay. And they always have a duty to cooperate. And the failure to cooperate relieves us from relieves us from having to indemnify you. And I suppose in an insurance indemnification contract for liability that if the policyholder doesn't cooperate, that inures to the benefit of the insurance company. They don't have to indemnify then because that's one of the policy defenses.
Right. If the insured wants to pay premiums and not take advantage of that, it's up to him.
Yeah, yeah. Is my analogy to an indemnification contract of insurance where, you know, you shall pay, we will pay, failure to cooperate, blah, 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 does that make sense in this context, or am I a little off base? And it's okay to say to me I'm a little off base. Just don't say it too loudly.
I don't know you can use that analogy strictly speaking, because there certainly is a difference between the state of Wisconsin and other public entities that are given protection under the statute and gratuitously are for the benefit of the public employees versus a private insurance company. Against which direct action can often be taken under many circumstances, and there's a contract there, so you can have a third-party beneficiary of that contract who can attempt to enforce it. 895-46 has never been construed to create a contract between the state and a state employee, which can be taken advantage of by another party as a third-party beneficiary.
My questions went to a policy of insurance for indemnification. Yeah.
Okay.
But your point is well taken.
Counselor, I have one more question on this problem that's bothering me. If I understand your argument, then it doesn't matter whether the trial court found that he was not acting within the scope of his employment, although you read us that little part, because once you've got a statement from the trial court, an order that state doesn't have to indemnify, that's really the end of the story. Right?
As far as the state is concerned, yes.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So it doesn't, even if there were, if it were permitted that Hendry be allowed to vacate that order, the plaintiff be allowed to vacate the order in regard to Hendry, as it applies to the latter part of what you read. It doesn't
be within the scope of employment?
Yes, it gives them no relief.
Right, and they have not disputed the fact that he did not cooperate in the defense.
Right.
I mean, just think of what you would be obligating the state to do, that you would be obligating the state to pay a judgment gotten against a state employee who won't help the state defend himself. I mean, just think in terms of the public policy argument here. Mm-hmm. Taxpayer money should go to pay someone for a wrong committed by a state employee who won't even help in his own defense.
Yeah, no, I understand the policy. I just want to be sure that I understood your argument, because before our discussion, I thought it was more important than perhaps it is whether he was acting within the scope of his employment. For you, that doesn't matter, because even if he were, you'd still be in the same place you are right now.
Correct.
Okay, good. I just want to be sure I understood. Thanks.
Thank you.
But the last sentence of 895-46 only applies to Mr. Hendry, does it not?
Correct.
So for Mr. Honig, you have to rely on something else.
Yes, he was. There's no argument that he was not within the scope of employment, nor that he did not cooperate in his defense.
Thank you, Mr. Glinski. Mr. Owens, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
All right, I have a few points to make. I want to pick up Judge Rogensack's point, and I want to call the Court's attention to my appellate's brief appendix, page 140, which was the transcript of the hearing at which the Attorney General filed this motion and the motion to dismiss. And on the appendix, page 140, there's a very lengthy, almost the whole page, she makes findings that, and it starts out, as pointed out in the complaint of the plaintiff, it is, in fact, Mr. Hendry's duties to investigate such complaint as part of his employment and clearly ask financial questions. And to that end, the plaintiff did seek questioning of that nature so that end which, under those other circumstances, may be very dismaying. I'll skip about elderly people and home repairs. This is a situation where Mr. Hendry was legitimately, shall we say, making visits to Ms. Werner, at least initially making appropriate inquiry, in the course. Obviously within the scope of his employment when this initial relationship, if you will, began. What is complained of here is that it went beyond that because of the frequency of his visits, because they occurred outside, shall we say, normal business hours, including evenings, and apparently on Sunday. She made a finding. It was within the scope. These were actions that were done during the scope of his employment, and that finding is inconsistent with the one-liner that the Attorney General quotes in a subsequent hearing. And Justice Rogensack points that out. This was her thinking laid out on the page, and that is why we got to a default judgment.
Stand before the microphone, please.
Thank you. That is why we got to a default judgment. So when we want to see her rationale, it's there. Clearly a finding that he was acting within the scope before he resigned. Not during the home invasion, but again, the notice of claim statute says growing out of or committed during. Growing out of or committed during the course of the discharge of your duties as a state employee. And this clearly is a finding that it grew out of or committed during. Second thing I want to point out, and this is important, I have a thinking statute, blow it up and make it into three sections like this. And I want to point out to the Court that I think the Court is being misled in that last sentence. I think that last sentence only applies to indemnification for attorney's fees. There is no comma at the last sentence. It says, not eligible for any indemnification or for provision of legal counsel. The paragraph above it talks about paying for the attorney that the person needs or providing counsel. And this language, if you read it carefully in the context of the third part, is all about indemnification for the costs of counsel or the provision of counsel. That gets us off the hook, I believe, on any conflict between the last sentence and the first sentence. Secondly, I need to point out that in the second part here, this Roman 2, that is the language that gives the Attorney General the right to stand in and may go into the question of whether it was committed or not committed in the course of committing of the duties without waiving sovereign immunity. Mr. Glinsky did not raise that issue. He never filed a motion on that. Look at his motion. It was that he did not cooperate. He did not raise that motion. He waived sovereign immunity. He never raised it, and he didn't file that motion. Mr. Glinsky only raised a motion that he failed to cooperate. And that is the point of the Attorney General's appeal. They are trying to make law here. They are trying to get this Court to expand and create a second obligation, which is to cooperate. How does a state employee cooperate who got killed in the accident? Or the state trooper who goes berserk and shoots somebody and shoots himself? I mean, you can't cooperate if you're dead, but they're off the hook. State's off the hook. Can't cooperate.
Counsel, let's say you prevail on the Hendry order. That's the indemnification with regard to the issue of the threshold issue of appeal. Was your appeal timely?
Yes.
What's this Court to do? If the Court would determine that the statute was misinterpreted by the Court of Appeals with regard to the Hendry order, and that this was, and you shouldn't have been precluded from appealing, should we send it back to the Court of Appeals for a determination on the merits of the indemnification issue?
I don't think so, Judge. I believe what we've got here is a judgment already taken, and the statute is self-executing. It's a mooted question as to Mr. Honick. The damages have been addressed. They would be the same as in a school bus accident if you've got multiple people and the issue is liability. It's been determined. The damages in this case have been determined. You only can collect them once. The state, however, at that point, if this judgment stands and is not barred, it's there. It's a judgment. It's against Honick.
Well, you still have the indemnification issue, though.
I think at that point I would probably present a claim to the state treasurer and say, we hold a judgment. He was acting within the scope of his duties, as Judge Grogan said, points out. The judgment is a judgment. It says he was paying. And maybe I have to bring a mandamus action and come back. But the case is done here. I don't think we need the Court of Appeals to do anything.
Counselor, do you know of any kind of a directive that you found during the course of this litigation that would have required Honick to take particular actions upon the receipt of the complaint of Ms. Werner?
No, no such thing, Your Honor. The discovery never got that far. It was a motion to dismiss. Thank you, Your Honors. My
time
has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Owens, and thank you, Mr. Brinsky, for your arguments on an issue that comes to us of immunity, but in a different format in this case. That concludes our hearing on 08-AP-2045, Evelyn Werner v. Kenneth Henry. The court is in recess for an hour and will return at 1:30 for its last case today. We are in recess.